I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas were smiling broadly as they shook hands across a table at a summit in Egypt. We'll have a report from Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt in a moment. But first, Federal Appeals Court Judge Michael Chertoff is expected to win easy confirmation in the full Senate as early as today, making him the next chief of Homeland Security. But at least one critic objects. As head of the criminal division in the Justice Department, Chertoff helped formulate the administration's legal response to 9/11. And Jessalyn Radick has filed a whistleblower lawsuit against the department, saying that Chertoff and others ignored her legal advice about the treatment of detainees. Jessalyn joins us now. And Jessalyn, we want to start in December of 2001. Now, you were a legal advisor in the Justice Department's Professional Responsibility Advisory Office. John Walker Lynn, the young American who became a follower of the Taliban, was detained. What were you told?
I was told that he had a lawyer, and I had advised that he should not be questioned without his lawyer. That was on a Friday. And then during the weekend, the FBI interviewed him anyway.
Without a lawyer.
Without a lawyer. And the attorney who had sought my advice called me back on Monday asking what they should do now. So at that point, I advised that the interview may have to be sealed and only used for intelligence gathering or national security purposes and not for criminal prosecution.
But then, 3 weeks later, then Attorney General John Ashcroft announced that, in fact, a criminal complaint was being filed against Lynn.
Right. And during that press conference, he stated that the subject here is entitled to choose his own lawyer and, to our knowledge, has not chosen a lawyer at this time.
So what's your reaction at that point?
My thoughts were twofold. One, that my advice had been ignored, but then the statement about, to our knowledge, he has not chosen a lawyer at this time, was contradictory to the operative facts with which I had been supplied a couple of weeks earlier.
Well, then three things happened. First, you got a scathingly bad job review. Then you found out that your advice wasn't submitted to court despite a court order. And you say that your emails that carried that advice were purged from your hard drive, and that's when you realized how important technical support is.
Right, exactly. I contacted the computer wizards at tech support and went to great lengths to resurrect the missing emails, and then I resigned.
And so now you have filed this whistleblower lawsuit. How does Michael Chertoff factor into your story?
He was questioned about my situation back during his judicial confirmation hearing. He was asked repeatedly by Senator Kennedy whether my office had rendered advice, and Chertoff denies over and over again that my office even gave advice.
Well, Jessalyn Radack, isn't there a chance that Michael Chertoff may not have seen your advice, that someone between you and him had eliminated your advice and your emails and your recommendations and it never got to him?
That is possible, though later on when confronted with the actual emails, Chertoff did admit that he became aware of my advice. He didn't say what sparked this recovered memory of his.
And do you think that he is responsible for your scathing review and ultimately for your either resigning or being fired?
I don't know if he personally is responsible for this scathing review, but it's been more than the scathing review. It's being forced out of my Justice Department job, fired from my next private sector job at the government's urging, placed under a pretextual criminal investigation that was closed with no charges being brought, put on the no-fly list.
You're on the no-fly list?
Apparently, there's no official way to verify that, though the last dozen times I've flown, I've had to undergo secondary security screening procedures.
Well, Jessalyn Radack, as you write in last Friday's Los Angeles Times, in an op-ed piece, Chertoff and the Justice Department mishandled Lynn's interrogation, then tried to cover it up and went after me for doing my job. He should not be confirmed as Director of Homeland Security. Why do you think it is that your charges against him aren't being given more weight?
Well, I think part of the problem is he keeps making what at best are misrepresentations and at worst perjury to Congress.
Well, John Walker Lind is serving a 20-year sentence. Do you think his case should be revisited?
I do, and I think his attorneys have petitioned for clemency, especially in light of the fact that Yasser Hamdi, who was captured at the same time in the same place fighting alongside Lind, was just released while Lind is serving 20 years in jail.
Jesselyn Radek is a whistleblower who is critical of Homeland Security nominee Michael Chertoff. She says she was forced from her job at the Justice Department and has accrued tremendous debt. She's filed a whistleblower lawsuit against the Justice Department. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Jesselyn, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, at today's highly anticipated summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas told Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon that Palestinians will halt all violence against Israelis. Sharon said Israel will stop targeting Palestinians. The host of the event, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, says the summit has provided a long-awaited positive moment after years of bloodshed. Greg Myrie is Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the New York Times. He joins us now. Greg, a positive moment, and yet the militant group Hamas has reportedly already called the deal into question.
Yes, that's true. The leaders of Israel and the Palestinians did make this announcement in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. However, Hamas, the Islamic group, says they're not bound by any ceasefire agreement. They say it expresses only the position of the Palestinian Authority and not the various factions. So we'll have to see what Hamas will do and how it will respond now.
In fact, let's have a quick review. The Oslo Accords process in the mid-90s was a breakthrough but then broke down. In 2000, Prime Minister Ehud Barak, Yasser Arafat, and President Clinton met at Camp David to try to restart a peaceful solution. Then in 2000 as well, Ariel Sharon, then running for prime minister, went to the Temple Mount or Dome of the Rock to an area reserved for Muslims. Some say that sparked this most recent intifada. Some say Arafat was already planning to call for an intifada. What is the sense? Is there a sense that this meeting today, you know, despite Hamas's objections to this peace statements, that this might mark the end of the intifada?
There's certainly that hope. I think that's getting a bit ahead of ourselves to say that it's over. It's certainly the most serious effort, and both parties seem to be much more invested in making this one work as compared to previous announcements of ceasefires that have not held. So I think that there is reason to be more hopeful. I think it's a bit too early to say the intifada is over. We will have to wait and see a bit.
What else has come out of today's talks? We hear to start that Ariel Sharon has invited Mahmoud Abbas to visit him, Sharon, at his ranch in southern Israel, you know, an olive branch. What else has come out of the talk so far?
Well, they formalized several things that they have announced in the previous weeks. Israel has made it clear they're going to release 900 Palestinian prisoners. It's not enough for the Palestinians, but it certainly is a move in the right direction. Israel says it's also going to pull back from its military presence around Palestinian cities in the West Bank. This is also significant from the Palestinian perspective. And the Palestinians say they're going to stop attacks. And if indeed that happens, that's a huge benefit for Israel. So they've made this commitment very publicly and now are more committed to it, I would say, than before. And if they can follow through, it could then lead back to the roadmap and to real peace talks. We're still sort of at a preliminary stage, but it's pointing in that direction.
How is the summit being received in Egypt? How are Egyptians responding?
Well, at the official level, I mean, it certainly shows a significant development. Hosni Mubarak has never met, the Egyptian president, has never met with Ariel Sharon in the 4 years that Mr. Sharon has been president. So their relationship has warmed greatly in the past few months in line with the sort of regional thawing. So that's a significant development. However, there have been protests among some college students in Cairo. So ordinary Egyptians still are to say the least, I think, very skeptical about the intentions of Ariel Sharon. So I think there is a bit of a difference between the official Egyptian position, which is warming towards Mr. Sharon, and the ordinary Egyptian position, which is still very skeptical.
We understand that Ariel Sharon said that he was making a direct address to the Palestinian people when he said, I assure you that we have a genuine intention obligation to respect your rights to live independently and in dignity. How are those words being received in Israel?
Well, this is something Mr. Sharon has been saying for a couple years now. He said to the Israeli people, we cannot continue to control, occupy the Palestinians. And he has said that he sees a Palestinian state emerging. So I don't think he surprised Israelis there. There's certainly a right wing in Israel that is very doubtful about what the Palestinians are actually going to do, and are they actually going to stop attacks, and are very suspicious of this process. But I think the kinds of things Mr. Sharon said publicly today are things he has been saying and are not really a surprise to Israelis.
And briefly, Greg, the tone of the meeting, at least from the photo opportunities that and the statements that are coming out of the closed-door meetings, the tone seems to be jovial. In fact, one of Israeli officials said smiling and joking.
Yes, don't want to make it sound like a big party, but certainly one of the most striking things was the fact that it did seem very relaxed. Here was Ariel Sharon, a man widely reviled in much of the Arab world, meeting very comfortably with three other Arab leaders and conducting a summit as if it was a very ordinary thing. I think that was actually perhaps the most striking element that we saw today.
Greg Myrie, is Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times. Greg, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we're joined now by Naomi Hazan. She's a former deputy speaker of the Israeli Knesset and a member of Israel's Meretz Party. She's currently a research fellow at MIT, joins us in the studio. Welcome, Professor.
It's nice to be here.
Your party, Meretz, falls in the peace camp, have I got that
yes,
accurately?
Absolutely.
And they have been critics of the hardline Likud party, which Sharon leads. Some are saying that today's potential peace summit is a victory for Israel's main hawk, Ariel Sharon. Your thoughts?
I think if it works, it's a victory for Israelis and Palestinians, and that's the most important thing. We've been deadlocked for over 4.5 years, and I think today's summit is important in a sense that, first, there's a cessation of hostilities, and secondly, there's the beginning of some momentum.
You mentioned it all depends on what could go wrong. Give us, before we take a quick break, your thoughts on what might go wrong.
Well, I think there's some things that we're fairly certain we have to anticipate. Number one, there's going to be violence because there's spoilers on both sides. And what's so important now is not to allow the spoilers to control the agenda again. They have for 4.5 years. So we have to brace ourselves for conducting negotiations with some violence and condemning that violence at the same time.
In fact, you say that there's a small possibility of civil war on either side. I want to ask you to hold that thought. When we return, we'll hear more from Professor Hazan about problems, possibilities, but also, why was a hawk Prime Minister Sharon shaking hands with Mahmoud Abbas today and not a peace camp politician such as Shimon Peres? Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation with Professor Naomi Hazan. She's a former deputy speaker of the Israeli Knesset, a member of the peace camp in Israel. She was just explaining that all sides have to expect that there will be some violence in response to today's talks in Egypt. And Professor, before we continue with some of your concerns about and hopes for today's meeting, I want to ask you about your thoughts about violence, because the Likud party, Sharon's people, generally say the process can only continue without violence. Do you think Sharon will be able to accept violence in order to move things ahead?
There are groups both in Israel and in Palestine that are deeply opposed to the process, because the process is all about a just and viable two-state solution. They'll do everything in their power to stymie the process. And therefore, we have to anticipate violence. And what we have to do is control and isolate it and denounce it.
You mentioned the hardliners that you were concerned about in Israel who still believed in the greater Israel, keeping the Palestinian territories as part of Israel. And today we see Sharon, who was, and today we see Ariel Sharon, who was one of the architects of the settler movement, so the godfather of the settler movement, and a proponent of greater Israel, and not Shimon Peres, shaking hands with Mahmoud Abbas. We see Sharon, not Peres, planning to confront settlers and remove them from Gaza, which is leading some to believe maybe his hardline approach originally was right and the peace activists were wrong, as in, you know, maybe it was Nixon who had to go to China. Your thoughts on that?
The analogy with Nixon is very commonplace now,
right.
Israel and Palestine are not China in the United States. I think there's been a tremendous transformation on all sides in the last few years, in two very important respects. Number one, there's a realization today more than ever before that there's no military solution to the conflict. Even though Israel has immense military power, it cannot defeat the Palestinian will for self-determination. And Palestinian militants cannot defeat Israel. So we're both here to stay. And that's a very important transformation. I think the second point is that Sharon was never an ideologue. I think he was misunderstood from that point of view. He was always and still is, an Israeli nationalist. His rationale for maintaining the territories up to now has been for security reasons. And I think now he understands that we need two states in order to maintain Israel as a democratic state with a Jewish majority. And that is a real shift. One has to respect it.
There are those who agree with you, and they say that he also realized it was way too expensive a proposition to keep the troops in Gaza. And then there are cynics who say that, in fact, he hasn't changed, and this is just his way of amputating the hand, so to speak, to save the arm, you know, getting rid of Gaza, which is the less desirable territory, to hold on to the West Bank, and put the whole process in formaldehyde and switch the gaze of the world to the Palestinians. Let's see what they do. That he really hasn't changed at all.
Well, again, it's very difficult to see what's happening and not say that there hasn't been some shift. There has been some shift. I think, again, that the most important problem is the definition of a Palestinian state. And Mr. Sharon has made absolutely no secret of his definition of a Palestinian state, which would cover 55% of the area occupied in 67, leaving large chunks of the West Bank in Israeli hands. I think that's a non-starter in terms of a viable peace agreement, and therefore the function of the peace camp is to continue to stress two points. There will be not a moment's quiet unless there is a fair solution, a fair two-state solution. The stronger the Palestinian state, the safer Israel. And also to stress once again that this has to be a negotiated settlement. It cannot be imposed. And that was the initial problem with the disengagement plan.
Shimon Peres was quoted in The New Yorker recently as saying it really doesn't matter what Sharon thinks he is doing, what his intentions are, that the peace process is back on the road.
Of course, that's the most important thing. And it's unimportant who is doing it. And to a certain extent, it's also unimportant what the motives are. What is extremely important, I would say essential, is the result. And we have failed in one large process, in the Oslo process. I don't think Israelis or Palestinians can afford to fail again. And therefore, every single effort must be made to make this process that is beginning today work. And that means learning from mistakes, not repeating them, and moving the timetable along, creating a momentum so that every week something positive is happening, which gives people hope, because I think both sides really are ready now to live a normal life.
A question from left field. In your view, how much did the recent elections in Iraq resonate in this region? How much, if at all, is what's happened in Iraq impacting what's happening in the Middle East?
Well, frankly, the Palestinian elections, which were held on January 9th, preceded the
right.
Iraqi elections. The Palestinians are in a series of elections. They're having local elections on a rolling basis. They had elections for the presidency
right.
Exactly a month ago. And they will have parliamentary elections this summer. So if there's a residence, it may be going in the opposite direction. If there is success on the Israeli-Palestinian front, I think it may have a positive impact on the situation in Iraq. Maybe the road to Baghdad goes through Jerusalem.
Professor Naomi Chazan is a former deputy speaker of the Israeli Knesset and a member of the Meretz Party in Israel. She's also a research fellow at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Professor, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, in the 1950s, one in three American workers was in a labor union. Now one in eight wears the union label. We ask former Democratic Congressman David Bonnier, now an advocate for workers, what went wrong? That's tomorrow. Stay with us as more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Much has been reported about the abuse of male detainees at the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. But what happened to the 90 women who have been detained at various facilities in Iraq since August of 2003? Of those, only two so-called high-value women detainees remain in custody. But for many of those released, life on the outside has meant stigma, even death, because Iraqis commonly believe the women were raped by American soldiers, even though the U.S. military says no reports of rape have been filed. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Tara McKelvey, a senior editor at the American Prospect magazine. She's written about her investigation into the women detainees. Welcome, Tara.
Thank you very much.
And Tara, we know that 42 women had been held at Abu Ghraib. How many and who did you speak to?
I spoke with four women who were held at Abu Ghraib. I spoke with one of them in person when I was in Jordan, and three of them I talked to on the phone.
Yeah. And what did they say?
They described different instances of abuse. Sometimes it took place during interrogations, and sometimes just while they were at the prison. Mm-hmm. And the stories they told were pretty startling.
Such as?
Well, one of the women who had been captured by U.S. forces said that she had been forced to dispose of human waste at one of the detention camps. And it was this very strange story about how she had to stir this metal container of human waste that was doused with lighter fluid. And she was out at a detention facility in like 110-degree weather and stirring at a certain point. She was 55 years old. She was really tired. She said she wanted to stop, and the soldier said, if you don't keep stirring, I'll have one of the soldiers rape you. Mm. So she had to continue.
Were you able to independently corroborate those kinds of stories, the stories of having to stir human waste? And were you able to find out if those things didn't indeed happen at the prison?
Well, with this particular story, it had this sort of nightmarish quality to it. I just couldn't imagine how it had actually happened. But then later when I got back to Washington, I talked to a human rights worker who had interviewed another woman who'd been held at Tikrit at the same camp, who told me the same story.
Well, now, what did the women tell you about sexual abuse and rape?
It's very difficult for them to talk about this kind of thing. I mean, it's hard enough for women in the West to talk about it. And Iraq, there's all kinds of stigmas attached to it, and some of the women could actually be in great danger if they admitted that they were sexually assaulted. So none of them said explicitly, I was raped or I was sexually assaulted. But when I asked questions about that, they would either start to cry or, you know, with the woman I spoke with in Jordan, she would turn away and hide her face, or they would say things like, I can't remember.
Yeah. You spoke to six Iraqi male detainees who said that they saw incidents of women being raped.
Yeah, they talked about some of the men. A lot of the times that they would, since they were separate from the woman at the in the cell blocks, they could hear things happening in the other camps. So, for instance, this one man told me when he was being interrogated, he could hear the sounds of women and children being tortured in other rooms. And he said it, he thought it was part of the interrogation process. They would terrorize them with these kinds of noise from other places.
Well, now you mentioned images from the U.S. government Taguba report and images in there of women, you know, baring their breasts, naked male and female detainees. There's also been reporting about a picture of a soldier, a U.S. soldier, having sex with a female detainee. It was reported in The Guardian. Her name was Noor.
I asked everybody about it, but I was never able to get enough information that I felt comfortable with publishing it.
So given that, and given that information in general was so hard to come by, did you ever think you were being duped by some of the women and men who'd been detained and might have had a grudge against the U.S.?
Well, I thought about that a lot. I mean, I was worried. I was going to Jordan. You know, what do I know about these women, these men that I'm going to meet? I knew nothing about them. I tried to do everything I could to determine the stories to make sure that they were telling me the truth. One of the things I did was I corroborated the accounts that they gave me with the military. I made sure that the dates matched up. I got prison numbers and had a very friendly guy in Baghdad help me out in backing up their stories. And I also saw a lot of similarities between the accounts, among the accounts that I got. They seemed pretty much the same. And then I also trusted the people who I met in from Baghdad. I asked them, are these women telling the truth? You know, am I getting the real story?
And these are the interpreters you used.
The interpreters. And then I had this fabulous fixer. We call them fixers because if they're, you know, it's somebody when you go to Jordan, it's somebody who will help you out and get through the customs and so on. And this woman named Rania Kadri was very skeptical in the beginning. She'd been working with lots of Western journalists and said she'd seen all kinds of fraud and Iraqis trying to pass off, you know, lies as something that had actually happened. She spent time with me and the woman that I was interviewing, and then halfway through the interview, she looked at me and she said, yeah, she's the real thing.
Well, and what does the government say about, you know, the possibility that these Iraqi women had been raped while in prison?
When I talk to the people in the government, they say they do not have allegations from the woman. They do not have complaints from these women, and they don't have any proof that rapes or sexual assaults occurred in the ways that I described it. But they also say, they do not say that they didn't occur. They simply say that they have not received information from the woman that I've talked to or from other former detainees.
No allegations. And is this, you know, is this getting caught in a catch-22? Because as people told you, and as you write in the article, many of these women would rather die than come forward and make a charge of rape.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, it's not surprising that they haven't come forward. And I did talk to the military about that. I said, these women are very afraid. And they said, well, that they have a human rights office in Baghdad with female employees. And I said, well, have any of the former detainees come forward? And they said no.
Yeah. Tara McKelvey, what is happening now? Are there any detainees, you know, filing suits? Is it, you know, if they're not coming forward and making charges, is there any other exploration ongoing of what happened?
Some of them are involved in a lawsuit that's being filed against private contractors. This is a. These are two lawsuits that are being filed against Titan, which is based in San Diego, and then the other one is Khaki International, which is Virginia. And these are private contractors who sent over interrogators and translators to Abu Ghraib. And the lawsuit says that some of their employees supposedly had some kind of role in the mistreatment of the detainees.
So why would these women be a part of that lawsuit and not charge the military with any kind of malfeasance?
Right. I talked to the lawyers about that. I said, why aren't you going after the government? And the lawyers seemed to think that they would have a stronger case, so it would be easier for them to press charges or to file these lawsuits against the private contractors.
Yeah. And so some of these women are in that lawsuit?
At least one of them is.
And what are they going to say? Are they going to say that they were raped?
When I talked to the lawyers about that, they said that if the woman, even the woman that I met in Jordan, if she were to describe what took place in the Tikrit detention center, that enough is abuse. That's enough. They don't need to go and say anything more explicit.
Terry McKelvey is a senior editor at the American Prospect magazine. And by the way, she's currently working on a follow-up story about the 64 juveniles currently being held by the U.S. military in Iraq, two as young as 13, 10 slated to be released soon. The others face charges such as throwing grenades and attempting to hijack a truck. Well, as always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. Well, still to come, the roving rally through the streets of Boston in honor of the Patriots, and some music for Fat No P Tuesday. You're listening to Here and Now. Tomorrow marks the beginning of Lent and the end of the time known as Carnival, which is celebrated in many cities, most famously New Orleans and Rio de Janeiro, which boasts Brazilians dressed in elaborate costumes parading through the streets. But the celebration is at heart a Christian tradition, and some Christians in Rio focus much more on the religious aspects. Brother Michael is a monk at the Monastery of St. Benedict of Rio de Janeiro, and he spoke with producer Will Thompson.
It's almost impossible to be surrounded by a city as huge as Rio is and not to have any kind of contact with the exterior world. It's a very dangerous city, you know, in this aspect. I mean, it has a very luxurious side with Carnival, and we are just downtown. Although Carnival is in the center, we don't listen to the noise. But we see the pictures in the newspaper, and the abbot can't avoid this. And we just see it, and it's fine. I mean, we know what is happening, but... It's an industry. It's like Hollywood. It's something that we try to sell. It's not real life. It's different from football. Even in the monastery, football, everything changes. We watch. We do watch television in the World Cup. Even if we have a prayer schedule, for example, 5:40, it's when the ring bells. It's holy. We can never change this. Every single day of our lives, we have to be there. It will never change. It only changes in the World Cup. Oh, yeah. Last year, we have to change the bells because we wanted to watch, and everybody does. Everybody's watching, even the monks. When I entered all together with 9, and I'm the only one. One year we have 11, no one stayed. Sometimes I think they come for this beautiful and aesthetical side, which is, oh, the chant, the Gregorian chant is so beautiful, how I wanted to use my hood and to be in silence away from my mom and my father. And this is not real life. I mean, real life is hard. Real life is brush your teeth every day and do the things that everybody do. In the monastery, there are no way out. I mean, it's only you and God. You will see and you will discover that you are not the one you thought you were. Because you will be, it's like a mirror. The monastery shows in your face, this is how you are. These are all your problems. Look how you behave yourself. It is impossible to find God if you don't know who you are. You have to find who you are and to find yourself in the monastery, and only then you can find God. And this, it's not for everybody. I mean, sometimes people don't want to see their worst side. Saint Benedict wanted the monastery to be like a lighthouse. We don't go to the people. They come to us. Right now we are surrounded. 400 years after, we are surrounded by the city. Saint Benedict, he wanted to build a school of the service of the Lord. It's something like an army. It's a little bit military. I think he had this in mind. So we don't talk while we are inside the monastery. We don't talk to each other. If we don't have something like a silent atmosphere in the monastery, life is unbearable. I mean, we don't talk while we are having lunch. We don't talk while we are having dinner because if you enter the monastery today, you'll be seated at my side, not only tomorrow, but for the rest of our lives. If I talk to you every day, the first day I know everything about your family, and the second day we don't have nothing to talk, in the third day I cannot talk to you anymore because we are having problems. Silence is very important because it gives a peaceful atmosphere. And God, you can only talk to God and listen to God in the silence.
Brother Michael is a monk at the Monastery of St. Benedict of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. Our visit to the monastery was produced by Will Thompson. Us, there's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now with this quick sports check-in. The Patriots are rolling through downtown Boston today after Sunday's Super Bowl win. Bostonians, incredibly, are getting used to this. We feted the World Series champion Boston Red Sox a few months ago in the same way. Now the city's land and sea duck boats are carting Patriots players and coaches around in a rolling rally. The team returned triumphant to town yesterday, the third time the Pats have brought home a Super Bowl trophy in 4 years. And Here Now's Martha Biebinger is out there on the trail. Martha, what's it like out there?
Lots of excitement, Robin. We've got the flags waving, the blue, red, and white confetti is being pumped off those duck boats along with the music. The players are pumping the victory sign. They're filming the fans who couldn't be more excited about catching the eye of their favorite player. They're tossing hats back and forth for autographs, signs for autographs. It's a big celebration.
And this kind of rolling rally is relatively new to this city. What happens is it goes through many streets, so people can see it. With deep apologies to our listeners in Philadelphia, who, of course, they lost on Sunday. Is it possible that Bostonians are getting used to this?
It is possible. They're getting very used to it. They're settling in for year four next year. Being a dynasty is not really that hard, Robin. That's what most people are telling me.
Yeah, who knew?
They're pretty into it, yeah.
Who knew?
Getting rid of that years of guilt and agony is not hard.
Well, Martha Biebinger, out there somewhere in the middle of a rolling rally, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, we leave the party on Boylston Street in Boston to join the one on Bourbon Street. But if you can't make it to New Orleans for the Mardi Gras, three new CDs will put you in the mood wherever you are. Here Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs is here to do just that. Hi, James.
How are you, Robin?
I'm fine, because these sound fabulous. Let's get right to it. The first is from the world music label Putumayo, an anthology?
Indeed it is. The collection is called New Orleans. And it features nationally known artists, both living and no longer with us, such as Satchmo the Great, Louis Armstrong, and Louis Prima, and the Preservation Hall Hot Four. And also local favorites, such as Topsy Chapman and the Pros, and Kevin Clark and the Jazz Revolution, and the guy we're about to hear, Deacon John, a fixture on the New Orleans scene for some years. The tune that we're going to hear was written by a 1940s R&B star named Joe Liggins. This is his song called Going Back to New Orleans. Dr. John also recorded it as the title track of his album back in 1992, if memory serves. And as felicitous coincidence would have it, Dr. John is also the pianist behind Deacon John on Going Back to New Orleans right now on Here and Now.
Going back home, T9A, to the land of the beautiful queens. I'm going back home to my baby. I'm going back to New Orleans. Gonna see Nene, my pa Rank, Cousin, and my ma and pa. Gonna plant my feet on Rampart Street and be there for the Mardi Gras.
It's Going Back to New Orleans by Deacon John with Dr. John in the background.
It really is a nice package, Robin, because in addition to learning quite a bit about the artist through the liner notes, et cetera, good photos and also a recipe for seafood gumbo courtesy of that noted practitioner of the culinary arts, as they say in New Orleans, Chef Paul Prudhomme, mm-hmm. Seafood gumbo, yaya.
Okay, so that's New Orleans, the CD on the Putumayo label.
And we'll hear something else from it in just a bit.
Right, but before we do, this label, Putumayo, has another CD out by trumpeter and vocalist Kermit Ruffins. And now a website has called him New Orleans' favorite entertainer. That's going far.
Well, you know, down there right now, he's probably the hottest street entertainer, club entertainer, et cetera, et cetera. He's a 40-year-old trumpeter vocalist in the Louis Armstrong tradition. Very strongly so, Kermit Ruffins is. He plays with that big, brassy sound common to the greatest New Orleans trumpeters. On the tune that we're going to hear, again on the Mardi Gras theme, is Kermit Ruffins' Do the Fat Tuesday. And he plays what I call in a second-line somber rhythm, which is a little bit different from the wheel-within-a-wheel street parade cadence that many Mardi Gras tunes use.
What do you mean by that, wheel-within-a-wheel?
Well, you know, we could probably demonstrate it together
okay.
on how to do it here.
All right.
You're responsible for the bass drum beat, and I'm going to give you the cadence. It is as follows. In 4-4 time, here we go. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Now I'm going to play the snare drum part with a highlighter on a music stand. This is the wheel within the wheel of New Orleans. That's the wheel within a wheel.
That's great. Well, thank you. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No.
So he does more straightforward.
Well, lines. No, this is, again, more of a samba feel. You'll hear it's a combination samba second line is the only way I can describe it. It's Kermit Ruffins and his band. And the tune, again, is called Do the Fat Tuesday, which it is today.
Fat Tuesday by Kermit Ruffins, the song that can be found on the new CD collection called Putumayo Presents Kermit Ruffins. And Kermit is one of the biggest entertainers, that you, as you said, in New Orleans.
Absolutely.
Now, the third and final CD is Los Hombres Calientes. Their new CD is Volume 5, Carnival.
And in this case, it's Carnival from all over the Caribbean. And they consider New Orleans to be the northernmost Caribbean city. So they visit New Orleans quite extensively in this collection, but they also take us to Cuba and to Trinidad, Haiti, and even down to Brazil, which of course isn't in the Caribbean, but the Afro-Brazilian strain figures very prominently in Los Hombres Calientes' work.
And we want to listen to the song George Porter, but first, who's George Porter?
George Porter is one of the greatest New Orleans funk musicians of all time. He was the bass player for the Meters. You remember the Meters in the 70s?
Sort of.
Well, the Meters recorded a bunch of albums. They no longer exist as the original Meters. There is a Meters offshoot that's come up since then. George Porter is the recipient of this tribute. He is also heard on bass on this track that is in his name, and it is New Orleans funk at its funkiest.
George Porter, a song performed by Los Hombres Calientes from their new CD, Carnival.
And Los Hombres Calientes are at this moment on tour of these United States, so maybe you can see them.
Excellent. Great selections all, James. I want to go out on another song from the first anthology you spoke of, New Orleans. It's on the Putumayo label. This is a song by Dr. John, who is also on tour now. It's called Basin Street Blues, and of course people are walking down Basin Street as we speak.
They are. This is a 1928 song written by Spencer Williams, introduced by Louis Armstrong. This tune features clarinetist Pete Fountain, and Dr. John plays the piano in the grand tradition of Jelly Roll Morton. Listen to the way he pronounces the word characters as characters.
Here knows jazz aficionado and character James Isaacs. For more information on the New Orleans jazz CDs, check our website here-now.org.
Basin Street is a street where all them characters from the first precinct meet. In New Orleans, city of a million dreams, and you never know how nice it seems when you're way down south in New Orleans. And you
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
I've been missing. Hear all that good music, Lord, if you just listen. Yeah, New Orleans is true. And that's why I got these Basin Street blues.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. On the web at mathworks.com.